So the British filmmaker, film director Christopher Nolan specialises in producing bamboozling, complicated, mind-bending films. And one of his most well-known, perhaps the most well-known, is his 2010 film, Inception. And in that film then, the setup then is that there is a multi-billionaire sort of business empire. There is a young man who's going to inherit that powerful business empire. And he's got a rival then who wants to destroy that business empire. And he can't do so by a direct attack on that man who's inheriting it. Instead, he does so indirectly through what then is called an inception. In the film, science fiction, of course, not fact. It bears no relation to what can actually be achieved through dreams. But he uses a series of dreams by which then, through the technique of this dream entry, an idea can be generated in the mind of this man who's going to inherit this empire, that will cause him then, the idea then, to break up his own empire and thus achieve the will of his rival. So the inception then is this entering into the mind through dreams, through his complex network of dreams, to create in his rival an idea that his rival would never have intended and didn't want to do. And the first example of inception is here in the Garden of Eden. Because it is by an inception, in that meaning, that Satan is able to create in the mind of Eve the idea of eating the forbidden fruit. You remember last week as we began to consider then this seduction of Eve by the serpent, that I said one of the great problems here is that she, like Adam, is completely innocent, pure and holy. Unlike us with our fallen natures, she was pure and holy and had so no desires, no inclination to sin at all. So Satan cannot come and fire those arrows outwardly at her because there is nothing to get at. There is no desire to get hold of. Instead, what he has to do is, as it were, get into her mind and generate from within her mind by his devious, seductive process. He has to generate from within her the idea to eat the forbidden fruit. Because it's her own idea, as we read, isn't it? She looks at the tree and sees it's good for fruit and its delight to the eyes and desire to be make one wise, and so eats it. Because throughout this seduction of Eve by Satan, he never says to her to eat it, does he? It's important to notice that Satan never directly says to the woman that she should eat of that fruit. This is part, of course, of his craftiness, isn't it? And it's the way of a seducer, is never to directly say what you're actually intending to achieve. Satan never directly says it. He insinuates it. He suggests it. But it's all indirect. It's all suggestive. It's all elusive. But by his seductive words then, he is able then to generate within Eve's mind this idea that she would never herself have wanted or intended to do. That's to disobey God by eating the forbidden fruit. And so it's this process then, this seduction process that Satan uses to create this inception, this idea in the woman's mind that I want us to focus on this evening. And the first key point then here is that all or everything that Satan says in these two little speeches he gives, every clause, every sentence Satan brings here is ambiguous. Satan's two speeches just laced with ambiguity. And this ambiguity is especially clear then in the Hebrew. And we'll just go and see some examples of this here now. So if you look at the first verse, when Satan says to the woman in his first speech, did God actually say, you shall not eat of any tree in the garden. Now, this did God actually say is an ambiguous statement. The commentator, Gordon Wenham, says of this. Does he mean, can I check that God said? Or, really, I can hardly believe that God would have said that. It's ambiguous. To spell it out a little further, Satan could innocently mean, can I just check, is it correct, this that God said to you? Or, and what he does mean is, really? I can hardly believe my ears. Surely it cannot be true that God could have said this to you. But it's ambiguous. And of course, the way of the seducer is to be ambiguous. A man wanting to seduce a woman doesn't just go up to her and say, would you like to come to bed with me? He's indirect, he's suggestive, he's elusive. So at any point, he can deny what he's saying. Deniability is key here. So that, you know, if the woman suddenly says, whoa, hang on, what are you doing? He'll just say, well, you know, I was just admiring your beauty, or something like that. He'll back off and give an alternative interpretation to his ambiguous language. And so here, if Eve had said, you're surely not challenging what God had said, are you, Satan? Satan would say, no, I just wanted to check that I had it correct. So throughout, Satan uses ambiguity because it allows deniability. It's the way, then, of seduction, and it's a way of deceiving people, to gradually lead people into something that they would not do, step by step. Then again, there's ambiguity in the rest of what Satan says here, when he says you should not eat fruit of any tree, or you should not eat of any tree in the garden. The commentator, again, on Genesis Alders, he says, it can read, not from every tree, or not from any tree. It's meant to be ambiguous. The duplicity of the question was intended in order to be most effective in arousing suspicion in the mind of the woman. Or again, to spell it out in more fully than the commentator does there, Satan could be innocently saying, did God command you not to eat fruit from every tree? Or, as he really does mean, he's saying, surely did God command you not to eat from any tree at all in the garden? So again, if Eve came back at him and said, no, he'd say, no, I wasn't challenging that God would be that mean and say, don't eat from any tree at all. I was just checking, did you mean every tree? There are some exceptions. So it's deniable all the time, this ambiguous process that Satan uses. Or again, if we look at the second statement in verses 4 and 5, this again is laced with ambiguity. So when he says, you will not surely die, this again is ambiguous. Wenham again, commentator Wenham, he says, there's undoubtedly double entendre in this remark, you will not certainly die. Does it mean, certainly you will not die, or it's not certain whether you will die? The innocent interpretation is again Satan saying, well, I'm not sure you'll die. Maybe you will, maybe you won't. It's not certain here whether you'll die. Or, and what Satan again intends, is to deny what God is saying. Certainly, absolutely wrong, this, that you're going to die if you eat the fruit. So the ambiguity again enables then Satan, as it were, to back off, to deny the malevolent meaning that he intends by stepping back into the other, more innocent meaning, if Eve should come back at him with this. Now the rest of the statement, the rest of the words in verse 5 in this second speech from Satan, then we'll consider a little later, but they're full of ambiguity too. We'll come back to those because they fit closely together and have the greatest importance in what's going on here, I think. But just to pause and say that this is why we have a big doctrinal confession in our church. It's important that we are people who are clear in our statements, that we have the Westminster Confession of Faith in 69, Baptist Confession of Faith. We've augmented those with other statements pertinent to modern issues to make it crystal clear what we believe and what we teach in this church. No ambiguity. In 2 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 3, then, referring clearly to this passage, the Apostle Paul says, "I'm afraid that as a serpent deceived Eve by his cunning, your thoughts will be led astray from a sincere and pure devotion to Christ." And commenting on that, then, Philip Hughes says, Paul is concerned because he perceives that the Corinthian converts, though betrothed to the one bridegroom, are in grave danger of being seduced into unfaithfulness by the impostors who've invaded their community. So we have then these so-called false apostles or super apostles who were coming with this false teaching into Corinth, and Paul's warning them against the danger of these false teaching by referring to the ambiguous statements that Satan used in the Garden of Eden. The way he seduced Eve through the use of ambiguous statements. He's saying, this is the way of false teachers. This is the way that people are deceived and led into error and away from Jesus Christ. This is the satanic way, is of ambiguity and deceit. So beware. I want you to be very clear what the truth is. And we as a church always want to be very clear then of what the truth is. And I say that's why we have a very big statement or a series of statements of faith in our confessions. Because we want to be clear to ourselves and to everyone else what we believe and what we stand on in this church, in the service of our God. But return then to the passage and the seduction of Eve then. And the first statement then, with this ambiguity that we've seen. So what is Satan doing here? Well, he's undermining the goodness of God, isn't he? He's undermining the goodness of God. This is his first speech, James, to undermine the goodness of God. Because what he's saying is, I can hardly believe that God would actually say this to you, Eve. That you're not to eat from any tree at all in the Garden of Eden. How mean, how nasty, how unkind God is in treating you in such a way. He's a mean-spirited God. He's denying you the great blessings you could have if you would just eat of that fruit. So Satan's first step then, in his first speech, he uses the ambiguous language to conjure up these ideas. And they're ideas to say to Eve, to suggest to Eve, to insinuate into her mind, to get her to think bad things about God. To get her to think that God is a mean-spirited God. To get her to think that God doesn't really want the best for her and for Adam. And of course, his malign suggestion here through these ambiguous statements is successful, isn't it? We see it's successful because of Eve's response to what Satan says in his first speech. Because in verse 2, the woman says to the serpent, "We may eat of the fruit of the trees in the garden, but God said, you shall not eat of the fruit of the tree that's in the midst of the garden, neither shall you touch it, lest you die." So first of all, what we note is that Eve uses the word God rather than the full covenant name of the Lord God that's used throughout this passage. She uses a reduced word, as it were, for God. So she's beginning, as it were, that suggests that she's thinking less generously, less kindly about who God is and about his character. And most obviously, of course, she adds the words, "and you shall not touch it." So she, by saying that, she in her mind now has generated an idea of God as being not so good, of being not so kind, of being mean and restrictive towards her, by saying, He also said, don't touch it. That's how mean he is to me. I'm not even allowed to touch this fruit. Which, of course, the Lord never said. So Satan's insinuation, his ambiguous remarks, have begun to create then a negative view of the Lord in the mind of Eve, that he's not entirely good, but he's not in her best interests at heart. And again, we should pause and just reflect a little on this, shouldn't we? Because this is the way then in which many of God's commands are undermined, isn't it? God's commands are undermined by presenting God as mean and harsh. You shall not kill. But surely God wouldn't be so mean and harsh as to include unborn people in that category, would he? God wouldn't be so harsh as to mean that people who are suffering terribly with sickness and want to have their lives mercifully ended would be included in the commandment, you shall not kill. He's a good God. He's a kind God. God says to Timothy through Paul, you shall not permit a woman to teach or to have authority over a man. But God wouldn't be so mean. I mean, what we were talking about there when Paul wrote was rather uppity woman in that church who were a bit pushy. He wouldn't be so mean as to include educated, professional women in the 21st century. In this category. No, no, no. God's a kind God. He's not a mean, nasty God. Undermining the character of God, misrepresenting God, is a way round then plain statements, plain commands that the Lord brings. It's the way of Satan. In undermining God's character, it enables us people, human beings, to try and get round his commands and not keep them and obey them as they are meant clearly to be kept and obeyed. So by then this ambiguous language in his first speech, the first step is to undermine the character of God, creating in Eve's mind these harsh thoughts of a harsh and unkind God who's very restrictive and mean-spirited. But then we have the second statement in verses 4 and 5. And this is a shocking statement. And it's shocking when we read the whole passage. And I think we perhaps often miss, we're so familiar with this, we perhaps miss how shocking this is. Because when you read this passage, what you find is that when you read it, Satan seems to be telling the truth and God seems to be deceiving. That's what's shocking when you read it, isn't it? God says to Adam, not to eat of the fruit of the tree, or you will die. Satan says, we read in verse 4 of chapter 3, you will not die. What happens after they eat the fruit? They don't die. They don't die. So it appears then Satan is right. He's telling the truth. You won't die, he says, and they don't die. And God is wrong. He's deceiving them by saying, you will die, because they don't die. As we read on through Genesis, you remember particularly in chapter 5, where you have that genealogy, and it's so-and-so begets so-and-so, had so many sons and daughters, and lived so many years, and then he died. And then he died. Death meant biological death, medical death, and it meant Satan is saying, you're going to not die. And he's right, isn't he? Or again, Satan says to Eve, when you eat the fruit, your eyes will be opened. And we read in verse 7, their eyes were opened. Satan's right, isn't he? He's telling the truth. Or again, Satan says, your eyes will be opened and you will be like God, knowing good and evil if you eat this fruit. You'll be like God, knowing good and evil. And what happens? Well, verse 22. The Lord himself says to us, man has become like us. That's like God, knowing good and evil. So again, Satan He's telling the truth, isn't he? What he says is what happens. Their eyes are opened. They become like God. They learn good and evil. That's what I mean, it's shocking. Because, you know, you're all sitting there thinking, but hang on, there's something a bit fishy about all this. This can't be right. And we're meant to be like, it's meant to make us think. We read this and we think, hang on, what's going on here? This can't be right. There's something about the way I'm reading this. And I, this can't be right because God is the God of truth and Satan's the father of lies. This can't be. There's something wrong here. And we're meant to think then. It's meant to make us think about what's happening here. So if you're thinking, Alan's making us work really hard and thinking through this passage, well, we're meant to work hard at thinking about what's happening here. Because, as I say, on a superficial reading, if you read through it, you read it, you think, well, Satan is right and God's wrong. Or even, as I say, Satan's telling the truth and God's lying. Now, that isn't correct. That isn't correct. But why is that not correct? And it goes back, of course, to the ambiguity in the statement Satan makes. Because Satan is meaning one thing, and God intended something else when he said not to eat the fruit of the tree. So last week, when we thought about the meaning of the tree, of the knowledge in good and evil, I said that this phrase, the knowledge of good and evil, was about right decision making. How it's used elsewhere in the Bible. It's about making the right decisions. The right decisions being decisions then which are wise and made in the fear of God. The right decisions. It was a tree by which Adam and Eve, through not eating, would learn how to make right decisions. Learn, therefore, right from wrong. Good from evil. And in that process, be matured. Be made more godly. That is, more like God in moral character. That's what the tree was about. Now, how much Adam and Eve understood of that, we don't know. They seemed to understand something of it, because Eve, as we see, could see that it was good for wisdom, so they understand something about it, and it's called the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, which itself suggests this. But they certainly didn't know all of it, and that's why it was important, as I said last week, there was a test of obedience to them. It's a test of obedience because they didn't really have to trust God. They had to submit to God and obey because God says so, without fully understanding the reasons. But the point is, you see, that whether you eat or not eat, there is an outcome. Whether you eat or not eat, there is change. Whether you eat or not eat, there is learning about right and wrong. And it's just a case of whether you learn it from the side of having done wrong and evil, or you learn about it from the side of having done right and honoured God. And one of the key things here is when Satan says you will be like God, what does he mean? God intends the not eating of this tree to make them like God, in the sense of becoming more godly, more godlike in character. Satan means you will become your own gods. You will become like gods yourselves, independent from God, making your own decisions, living your own lives without God, free from the restrictions that God places upon you. You will become your own gods. So to illustrate then, try to help us to understand what's going on here. Imagine then there's a woman, a Christian woman, she's been shopping at the supermarket and she's walking back with a trolley to the car. And she sees a wallet on the ground. She picks up the wallet and there's credit cards and things in it. But there's also a whole wedge of money, lots of cash. Looks like a few £100s, must have been to the cash point just before. She's a bit hard up. Short of money. She's tempted then. Well, you know, there's nobody around. Nobody would notice. Nobody in the car park. Who would know if I just took out this money and pocketed it? Dropped the wallet on the ground, you know, kicked it away, out of sight. Could do with this, a few £100s, looks good. But she doesn't do that. She takes the wallet back into the supermarket and finds some of the people working the store and the supervisor and gets it announced of the tannoy in case the owner's in the store, and they phone the police and so on. So she made the right decision, the God-like decision in doing that. She had a decision and she made the right decision, the God-honouring, the God-like decision. And in doing so, she honoured the Lord and had the pleasure of doing so. Had she taken the money and kicked it under the car and done the wrong thing, what would have been the outcome? Well, she would have felt guilty and shamed, wouldn't she? Her eyes, in the language of Genesis 3, would have been opened, but not opened to a purer and better knowledge and relationship with God. They would have been opened to an experience as a sinner of transgression, an experience of shame and guilt. If she had gone that route and done wrong, she would have learned good and evil from the side of making the bad decision. She would have learned it from the side of shame. And so in the Garden of Eden here, as Eve is confronted with this choice and deceived by Satan's seductive wiles into this, she can go in the same sort of way either way. If she remains and honours God by not eating, then she matures. She increases in her relationship with God. She learns good and evil from the side of doing right, from doing good. Her correct decision matures her, makes her more godly, more godlike. But if she does the bad thing, which she does, she tries to be independent from God, making her own decisions against God's will by disobeying, she's asserting that she will be her own God, God herself, making independent decisions from God. And that is, of course, the way she goes. So her eyes are opened to the shame of sin, not to a deeper knowledge of God. And she gains a knowledge, and Adam afterwards gains a knowledge of good and evil, as the Lord says, verse 22, but it's the knowledge of good and evil from sinning, from the experience of disobedience and rebellion against God. And they become like God in the sense of asserting their independence and making their own decisions, as if they can run their lives in their own way. So all Satan's statements in verse 5, you see the opening of the eyes, being like God, learning good and evil, are again ambiguous. Each one is ambiguous. Each one then is part of his seducing of Eve into doing wrong by putting into her mind then the thought that being like God, or being a God, making her own decisions, becoming wise, is the right thing to do. He's created in Eve then through first undermining the character of God and now insinuating that she can get everything by eating the fruit and disobeying. He creates in her then this idea that eating the fruit is the right thing to do, to be like God, to gain wisdom, to have her eyes opened. But because she's been seduced, it's all in the wrong way. It's all in the evil way. And so, of course, she does die, doesn't she? When we think, well, hang on, they don't die. They go on living for many, many years, 900 years, 980-something years in Adam's case, very long time. This is because we're meant to think, well, hang on, what is life? And what is death here? And life is being in a relationship with God. Life is what they had in the Garden of Eden when they walked and talked with God, when they communed with him, when they enjoyed open access to the presence of God, as pure and holy men and women. That was life. And they die because when they sin, they run away from God, don't they? They run and hide. That is death. They are separated now from God. That relationship with God has been cut. They've been severed from God by their sin. That is death. Death is being cut off from God. Death is not knowing God. Death is not enjoying that heavenly relationship with God which Adam and Eve enjoyed before this sin. So we learn here the real meaning of life and death. And we're meant to think this through and think, ah, yes. Because real life is loving and knowing God. And death has been cut off and separated from God by our sin. And so you see then how Satan, by this seductive process, insinuating with all these ambiguous statements, creates in Eve this desire to do what she thinks is the right thing. This is what's key. She thinks she's doing the right thing. Because to get an innocent person like Eve to sin, she's got to think she's doing the right thing. Becoming like God, knowing good and evil, getting wisdom. But she's been deceived by the serpent, and what she thinks is the right thing is, of course, a gross transgression. He's enticed her with these ambiguous words into this catastrophic sin. And at the heart of this sin, then, is this becoming like God. Nor in the sense that the Lord wants us to become like him in moral character, but becoming like God in the sinner's way, of asserting independence proudly and defiantly, of asserting that we are gods who will run our own lives, thank you very much, without reference to God, and without needing to keep all these restrictive and mean-spirited commands he gives us. The way then of sin for Eve was the way of this independent assertion of aiming to be like God by becoming independent from him. It's not clear how much Eve understood exactly what she was doing because it's all ambiguous. But she's tantalized, she's seduced, she's led into doing this evil thing by the wiles of Satan. And as I said then at the start, this is Satan doing this in an innocent, not able then to get a grip from the outside with direct remarks and statements, but working by ambiguity, this deceitfulness, the thoughts within. And he can do the same to you and to me, as Paul warned those Corinthians, through false teachers and so on. Satan down the ages works lies and deceit to create in us thoughts, ideas that we want to own as our own, but which are actually suggested and cultivated by these deceitful wiles of the evil one. And how much do we then need the Lord's help, the Spirit's help, the Spirit of our Savior Jesus Christ's help then, to be wise and careful and carefully examine as we fight the good fight of faith in the Lord's service against the wiles of the evil one. We who are so much more vulnerable than the pure and innocent Adam and Eve in Eden to the way that Satan can try to create in our own minds thoughts and thus actions that will dishonour our God. May he help us then to be wise and understanding in his service. Amen. So we'll close with number 757. 757.